Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Chip Blacker from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, and it is my privilege to host this evening's event. It's a special pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Senator Gary Hart. As many of you know, Senator Hart, who may also be addressed as Professor Hart, or also Mr. Hart, served with distinction in the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987, representing the state of Colorado. While in the Senate, he was a leading voice on issues having to do with U.S.-Soviet relations, nuclear arms control, and probably most famously, military reform. Putting us academics to shame, he is also the author of 16 books. Let me repeat that, 16 books, including the widely acclaimed study, The Fourth Power, A Grand Strategy for the United States in the 21st Century. Senator Hart holds law and divinity degrees from Yale University, and in 2001, he earned a DPhil in politics from Oxford University. Early in 2005, he returned to Oxford, where he began work, this is so painful for an academic to say, on his latest book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons, which has just been released and which he will talk about with us this evening. Co-chair of the U.S. Commission on National Security for the 21st Century, Senator Hart warned of a catastrophic terrorist attack on American soil as early as the fall of 1999 and spent the first 8 months of 2001 trying to persuade our leaders that the threat was urgent and that immediate action was required. I said at the outset of my introduction that it's a special pleasure for me to introduce tonight's guest, and I meant it. It's not every day that one gets the opportunity to introduce one's former boss. I had the privilege of working for Senator Hart in the early 1980s, first as a legislative assistant working on U.S.-Soviet relations and nuclear arms control issues, and later as a foreign policy advisor during his 1984 bid for the presidency. Much has changed in the intervening 22 years since we first met, certainly for Senator Hart, for me, and indeed, I suspect, for all of you. But some things have endured, and most especially in this context, my profound respect for Senator Hart, both for who he is and for what he has done. It's always been an honor and a privilege, Gary. So please join me in welcoming to the podium Senator, Professor Gary Hart.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I apologize for being late, but like Jerry Rice, since my playing days, I've lost a step or two. And I'm particularly sorry to have missed the wine and cheese in case there's any left. I could probably profit from, forget the cheese, let's say. Actually, Chip, if you can raise the money, I'd like that introduction inscribed on my tombstone, thus guaranteeing a very large tombstone. Chip did not work for me, I worked for him. That was the only correction I would have in the introduction. And the other correction would be, I wrote another book last night, so it's now... I think we're up to 17 or 18. I keep writing them in the hope that someday somebody will read one of them. I am mostly delighted to be back at the Commonwealth Club. It's been my honor to appear before this truly historic and august forum on, I think, more than one occasion in the past, and I'm once again honored by your invitation, being a humble professor from the University of Colorado now, and mostly just looking for anybody to talk to. So thank you for being here, and thank you for your invitation. Let me explain, if I may, because I'm obliged to my publisher to do so, both the title of this book and if possible, in 90 seconds, basically what it's about. The title is The Security and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. I'm sorry, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. And the book makes basically two arguments, just to save you $22. First is that the meaning of security in the 21st century is going to be much, much different from what it was in the 20th century when Chip and I and others were working on national security. And the second argument is that the notion of national security is rapidly disappearing. Thus, the subtitle of the Security of the Commons. Let me, if I may, in a few minutes, just round out those two arguments. In the Cold War era, the central organizing principle of our country from basically 1947 to 1991, I had the convenience of being short and disposable on a bumper strip, and it was, of course, containment of communism, basically flowing from early writings of the late George Kennan and other thinkers at the time as to what was America's role in the post-World War II era and what threats, basically threats, did we face. And to his credit, President Truman at the time appointed an ad hoc group of a set of commissions and committees to go away and think about this and come back and advise him, and various committees did so. And they said basically two things based on Kennan's advice and other people's biases and prejudices. The Soviets are coming and they're 30 feet tall, and we cannot permit them to occupy Western Europe and Asia and the Middle East and elsewhere. So we must contain them. And that, as I say, became the dominant foreign policy and defense organizing principle for the next 8 or 9, or perhaps 7 or 8 administrations. And with varying degrees of intensity, that's the way we organized our foreign policy and our defense policy. It caused us, you'll be not surprised to know, to certain excesses. We tried to assassinate foreign leaders, including, with almost demented insistence, Fidel Castro. We spied on our own citizens. I know you find that a horrifying thought. We listened to their phone calls. We overthrew some governments and imposed people more friendly to us and more, we believed at least, more anti-communist. We got ourselves involved in a number of wars of national liberation, almost always on the theory that the insurgents were pro-communist, and if the government in power, even though a repressive one, were to fall, it would hurt our chances in this Cold War confrontation. As I say in the book, this was basically a two-dimensional chessboard, and the rules came to be pretty well codified on all sides. In fact, there were got to be, I guess, by the 80s, late 80s, almost ritualistic efforts to control arms and put limits on the development of weapon systems and reduce them. And those rituals were carried out by and large in Geneva and the capitals of Moscow and Washington. But security in this period, 47 to 91, to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the ancient Russian Empire, was basically defined by the prevention of an exchange of nuclear weapons between the United States and the Soviet Union and the encroachment of the Soviet Union into Western Europe. That was the definition of security, and the phrase national security dominated the work of Chip Blacker and a host of other experts in this field. But my argument here, first of all, is that in the new century, a very new and different century, that definition of national security, not just because the Soviet Union has disappeared, but that narrow, if you will, almost militaristic definition of what it means to be secure isn't going to work anymore. Let's look at this new world. As I've argued in this book and 5 or 10 previous ones, we are not living in an age that is simply a continuation of the 20th century. I mean, most of us see life and history on a continuum. My argument, first of all, is that we're living in an historic revolutionary period on multiple levels. I think there are at least 4 major revolutions going on, and they are so profound that, and we are so much in the center of them, that often we don't even realize the immensity and the epic nature of these revolutions. First of all, globalization. The internationalization of finance, commerce, and trade is a huge revolution by any dimension. And by itself, it would have caused turmoil in the world, but it happens to occur simultaneously with another huge economic revolution and social revolution called the information revolution, largely originating within 50 or 100 miles of where we are tonight. That revolution was as profound economically and socially as the Industrial Revolution of the early 19th century, and it has transformed the way we think, the way we communicate, the way we learn, the way we do our work. And those two revolutions together have had two effects. One is to widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. If you are not a trading nation, if you don't have raw materials, finished products, services to trade, you're going to fall farther behind in this globalized world. Further, if you do not have access to these new means of communications and learning, basically the computer, but all of the spin-off ancillary products associated with it, you're also going to fall farther and farther behind. So that's change number one. Change number two is these two revolutions together have eroded the sovereignty of nation states. Now, we have come to believe since the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 that the basic building blocks of the world are nation states, Germany, France, China, Russia, the United States. But in the panoply of human history, the nation state is a fairly young concept, as I say, since the mid-17th century. And the nation state was created basically on this bargain. We, the state, will protect you, the nation, or the people, in exchange for your loyalty. And so the bargain was that the nation would believe that the state would provide security and therefore would be loyal to the state or the government. That was the basic bargain, and it was premised on this basic notion. The state had a monopoly on violence. So when globalization begins to erode the authority of the state, the ability of treasury departments and ministries of finance and central banks to control the economy of any single nation, which is rapidly disappearing, the sovereignty of the nation state is weakened. And further, when 19 terrorists can kill 3,000 Americans on American soil, the ability of the most powerful nation in human history to protect its citizens is called in question. These were not representatives of a nation state. They were, in fact, as they've called themselves, a stateless nation, or as foreign policy experts say, non-state actors. I prefer non-stateless nation because it makes the point. And when the sovereignty of the nation state is eroded and it loses its monopoly on violence, then you have a transformation of conflict and the very nature of warfare itself. And that's where we find ourselves today. So those are the four revolutions: globalization, information, erosion of sovereignty, and the changing nature of warfare and conflict. It is based on those observations that I now argue that security for us, and indeed for our allies and friends around the world, and much of the world itself, now is a bigger notion than it was 15 years ago. I argue in this book that security in the 21st century, for Americans at least, and many others, must include security of livelihood, the ability of wage earner to care for his or her family, increasingly his and her family, the security of the community, meaning you can be secure from terrorism, but if your major employer in your community is picked up and gone to Bangladesh, you're probably not feeling very secure because 1,000 or 2,000 of your neighbors have just lost their jobs. Security of the environment. Let's say you've got a means of livelihood, you're fairly comfortable, your community is safe, but let's say you've just come to the doctor's office. The doctor said your children are suffering from lung contamination from air pollution or the drinking water that they've ingested. You're not feeling very secure. And finally, security of energy supplies. If your son or daughter is just going off to join the Army or the Marine Corps to fight in Gulf War 3 or 4 or 5 so that your neighbor can drive his Humvee, you're probably not feeling very secure. So you're beginning to get the idea of what I'm trying to communicate here is, what does it mean to be secure in the 21st century? Now, if you think of it in my terms at least, or broaden your mind a bit from beyond the Cold War period, you immediately conclude that war on terrorism is not necessarily going to make us secure. Even if we got bin Laden and, after giving him a fair trial, hung him, it would still not cause us to be secure in this revolutionary world that I've described. So my first plea is for all of us as Americans, people particularly like yourself who will take an evening out to think about these ideas, or a week, or your whole lifetime, I suppose, to begin to think differently about the security of our nation. I had a colleague in the Senate, the late Gaylord Nelson, a very wise man and a funny man, who once, after hearing these endless debates on the floor of the Senate that Chip would know very well about, said, look, it's very simple. What security means is the security of our borders, a sound dollar, meaning a good expanding economy, and the confidence of the people in their government. Now think about that a bit. I mean, it resonated with me. I understand secure borders, even though ours are not at the present time. I understand a sound dollar. But what if you have both of those and people don't have confidence in their government anymore? It's probably not a secure nation. So this is kind of what I'm encouraging people to think about. And the second thing is, when I say the notion of national security is rapidly disappearing, I mean exactly that. Our founders were Republicans with a small r. They, in many cases, did not even like the word democracy. Certainly not Adams or Hamilton or Franklin. To them, that word meant mobs in the street. And occasionally that concept has characterized my party. But they used the language of the Republic, the ancient Republic of Greece and early Rome. And we salute the flag of the United States of America and the, not democracy, the republic for which it stands. Now, if we walked outside and stopped 10 citizens of San Francisco and said, tell me what, we salute the flag of the United States Republic, for what do you think a republic means? They probably couldn't tell you. When I grew up in about 100 years ago in Ottawa, Kansas, we had class in junior high, I guess, or high school called civics. And I don't remember much about civics, but I think it was a bit of a holdover from those early Republican days. And I would be amazed, probably some of you know, if any high school or school in America today has a course in civics. But the four things have characterized republics in the past. One is civic duty. They used to say civic virtue. And by the way, in an age of where politicians talk about faith and values, our founders talked about virtues. And I like that word much better than values, because values is pretty vague. Virtues is rooted in history, and certainly in Republican history. And basically what it meant in a simplistic way is this. A democracy is about the right to vote. A republic is about the duty to vote. And not just vote, to serve on juries, to help defend your country when it is under threat, to actively involve yourself in the life of the community, which you are doing here tonight, to take seriously your role as a member of a republic. The other qualities of the republic in history, in Greece, Rome, Machiavellian Renaissance era, Switzerland and the cantons, Venice as a republic, and finally the vast federated republic created by our founders, or federation of republics, I should say, was popular sovereignty. Now, we take that for granted. In more recent parlance, the Black Panther said, power to the people. That's basically what the early Republicans were talking about. There no king, no president, no ruler, no God, no authority has the sovereignty of a republic. The people have the sovereignty. It's a profound notion, 2,500 years ago. Third, resistance to corruption. Now, they didn't mean Jack Abramoff. They meant any one or group of people putting their interest ahead of the common good. That was considered corruption. Jefferson wrote about it. He said, the thing that threatens this country is if people put their own interest ahead of those things that we hold in common. And by that definition, by the way, today's republic in America is a massively corrupt republic, even before Jack Abramoff. And finally, a sense of the commonwealth and the common good are some of our early republics or colonies were called commonwealths. And that it is from that that I draw this notion of the commons, except the commons now isn't just what we as Americans hold in common, namely our security, our natural resources, a lot of other things that we own and possess together, but it's increasingly an international concept. Now, we've just, a few years back, instigated a war against a nation that did not represent a threat to us. And in doing so, even more problematically, we fractured alliances that had been carefully constructed over most of the last century to win two world wars and the Cold War. And we literally almost thumbed our nose at those allies unnecessarily, simply because they did not agree with us that Iraq represented a threat to the world. And so we just said, in effect, take a hike, or as I say in the book, the headline is, U.S. to allies drop dead. Now, the problem with that, you can say, well, fine, the perfidious French are not to be trusted anyway. But it's not that easy. Let's say that the head of the CIA tracks down a presumed terrorist based on NSA wiretaps, and that terrorist is last sighted in Paris. So the CIA director goes to the National Security Advisor and says, can you get a hold of the French security services and ask him to track this chap down? And they do so, and the head of the French security services said, well, you didn't want to listen to us a few years back. Why should we pay attention to you now? I don't think they'll respond that way, by the way. But the point is, we cannot defeat terrorism or achieve any of these other security objectives by ourselves. So this is an international undertaking. Security in the 21st century means security of livelihood, security of our communities, security of our borders, security of our environment, and security of our energy supplies at the least, and probably a great deal more, but it's a fairly slim book. And security cannot be achieved by the United States alone. Our default justification for the Iraq War was that we, after finding no weapons of mass destruction, finding no connection with al-Qaeda and all the rest of it, we deposed an evil dictator. Well, the last time I checked, there were at least 39 other evil dictators in the world. And I don't hear anyone in Washington talking about invading Zimbabwe to rescue the people of that belabored country from a cruel dictator called Robert Mugabe. This is why, even though I don't believe the war in Iraq was about, first of all, about oil, but to say it had nothing to do with oil is crazy. But this is why, when we have this gap of hypocrisy, which is a definition of hypocrisy is gap between what you say and what you do. And that's not only true of individuals, it's true of nations. We hold ourselves, claim to hold ourselves to the standard, and we often behave down here. And this does not go unnoticed by the people of the world. So when we say we're in the business of deposing evil dictators, we either have to follow through on that or explain why we pick and choose. Well, clearly, even though Donald Rumsfeld thumped his chest shortly after deposing Saddam Hussein about rattling some sabers vis-a-vis Iran and Syria, right now we couldn't invade those capitals. We might invade Syria and take over Damascus, but certainly not Iran, because we've depleted the finest military in the world, and it'll take 15 or 20 years to rebuild it. But the security that we, to achieve security in the 21st century, we need alliances. We need to rebuild the world community that we've pretty well left behind or left aside in this venture in the Middle East. And if I were to conclude, as I will, on these notes, I would simply say it is imperative that the United States have a national debate and dialogue over what security means. What do we mean when we talk about security, whether we use national security or anything else? And is national security achievable without the help of the rest of the world and the security of much of the rest of the world? And I think the answer is clearly no. Thank you all very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Hart. It's now time for us to go to the question and answer portion of the program. We have some very interesting questions that I'm eager to get to and eager to hear how Senator Hart responds to them. A good fistful of them have to do with the current brouhaha, as one questioner has put it, regarding the involvement of the UAE in U.S. ports and port security. So I thought I would open with an easy one for
somehow
you.
Thought I would,
you might
hear
one.
That tonight. Two or three quick observations. In the panoply of security issues, for example, compared to our dependence on Persian Gulf oil for our economic livelihood, the port issue is fairly small. That is to say, there are a lot bigger problems that we face in this country are the disarray in the Department of Homeland Security, demonstrated by Katrina, the vulnerability of the ports already, if Dubai was never heard of, our ports are extremely vulnerable. Read today's New York Times and the quotes from Commander Steve Flynn, who was an advisor to the U.S. Commission on National Security, first surfaced the port security issue 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, including in articles in Foreign Affairs, was the executive director of the task force that Warren Rudman and I chaired for the Council on Foreign Relations a year after 9/11, entitled America Still Vulnerable, America Still at Risk. And Steve Flynn is still at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he is the nation's leading expert on port security. And he says the Dubai issue is a problem, but it isn't our biggest problem. It's not even our biggest port problem. We have huge, hugely vulnerable ports already. I think we could have extracted from two observations on the process. The committee, Chip helped me out with this, Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFI something, that met in secret and deliberated on this issue, didn't even tell the president or the congressional leadership of their conclusions on a fairly what... I mean, they had to be politically tone-deaf not to understand that somebody might say, wait a minute. But they didn't. Didn't inform the president, didn't inform anyone else. The deal was announced, and all of a sudden people are scrambling around saying, wait a minute. We've just heard for 3 or 4 years about the perfidious Arabs and how they harbor terrorists and support terrorists and finance madrasas and on and on and on. And by the way, despite all that, we're going to give control of 6 or 7 of our keenest ports to one of the countries that may or may not have, but probably did finance some of the indirectly, some of the education, shall we say, or indoctrination of young potential terrorists. So we could have said to Dubai, all right, fine, this is a government-owned institution. We want the following conditions. One is We want to be able to, and this may not be enforceable because I'm just thinking off the top of my head, we want an end to any financing you may be giving to madrasas anywhere in the world, and we will audit your accounts to make sure that's not happening. Well, this is practically infeasible, but you get the idea of what I'm talking about. You don't just give them the contract. You say, we want some things in return. And I think the game was revealed earlier this afternoon or late afternoon. I did an interview, which probably be airing right now, with Mr. Bill O'Reilly. And this is what he wanted to talk about. And so I said at the end of it, on the issue of secrecy, I said, look, why can't the president just say, I said, there's something curious about this in that he's prepared to exercise the first veto in 5 years in the White House on this issue, and he didn't even know about it. This causes curiosity. Why is he so intense on this issue? And there are only two possibilities. One is somebody's making a lot of money on the deal, and possibly somebody that the president might know. And second, they are, in fact, as he has said, helping us in the war on terrorism. Well, what's that mean? So I said this to Mr. O'Reilly. Why didn't he just come out and say it? O'Reilly said, well, look, we've got a big CIA station there. We've got special forces there. We've got a Delta Force there. It's a base for us. And then he stopped, and I said, why can't the president just say that? He said, we can't let the enemy know what we're doing. I said, Mr. O'Reilly, is there no possibility at all that someone might be listening to your program?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former Senator Gary Hart, author of the just-released book, The Shield and the Cloak. Senator Hart, on a related issue, we've also received a number of questions. Curious to learn your views on the wiretap issue.
Yes.
And you know, well, whether or not you regard those as legal, illegal, et cetera.
It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what Alberto Gonzalez thinks. Harry Truman said many wise things, one of which stuck in my mind, and that was in his famous interviews with Merle Miller when he was back in St. Joe, Missouri, Liberty, Missouri, wherever. He said, the only new thing in the world is the history we haven't read. And the longer I live, the more I realize that. And let me give you the history. I came to the Senate January 1975. 3 weeks later, the Senate approved the creation of a Senate Select Committee to investigate the intelligence agencies of the U.S. government. And this all came out of the Nixon administration's response to Vietnam War protests. And what we uncovered were not only the assassination plots against foreign leaders, we uncovered massive internal surveillance of American citizens by this FBI and a host of other organizations. And we recommended to the Congress of the United States and the President major reforms. Two of those, of a number, three of them. One required the President to sign what was called a finding before we undertook a major covert operation. Because up to that time, the policy had been the President doesn't know. Even if he orders it, he doesn't know. So he can exercise plausible deniability. That is to say, gee whiz, I didn't know we were flying over flights over the Soviet Union, shame on us. Or, I didn't know about the Bay of Pigs. The CIA did it on its own. Well, to his credit, John Kennedy took responsibility. We haven't seen much of that recently, of a president saying, the buck stops here and I'm accountable. Anyway, two other reforms were the passage of the Intelligence Identification Protection Act in 1982, to protect the identity of undercover agents, and the so-called FISA Act, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created special courts to comply with the Fourth Amendment requirement for a judicial warrant before invading the privacy of American citizens. And that was handled by special judges having security clearances and so on. Well, the president has violated both of those acts, or somebody has in the White House, certainly the president in the second case, because nobody to this day, president on down, has, at least to my knowledge, accounted for why they could not go to those courts. They've been asked, I think the last count, Chip probably knows, 1,700 cases of specific surveillance and wiretap, and I think four have been denied because there was insufficient probable cause, the legal standard, for tapping that person's phone. Four out of 1,700. So it's not like these courts have been denying the government the ability to protect its citizens. And finally, just a quick story. I gather this 30-second means I should shut up.
No, you're fine.
No, okay. Here's a... You've got to believe in irony if you're around politics very long. The Intelligence Identification Protection Act wasn't just created out of thin air. Let me tell you what happened in the early 70s. There was a man called Philip Agee who claimed to have worked in the CIA, probably did, and he wrote a big book kind of revealing a lot of intelligence secrets. Then there was a magazine called Counterintelligence that, between the two of them, they began to out a whole lot of undercover intelligence people. And one of those named by Counterintelligence, or Counterspy, I guess it was called, was a man called Richard Welch. And Richard Welch happened to be the CIA station chief in Athens at the time, 74, 75. And he answered a knock on his door on Christmas Eve 1975 and was promptly shot dead within weeks after his identity being revealed. I got a call as a member of the Intelligence Committee, chaired by the late Frank Church, on Christmas Eve from the director of CIA, the late William Colby. Now, why, I still haven't in my mind figured out 30 years later why he called me, because on the committee was Barry Goldwater, John Tower, Howard Baker, a lot of other people much closer to the Ford administration. But for a variety of reasons that I could tell you tonight, but then I'd have to lock you up forever, Mr. Colby had gained some confidence in me. He said simply, can you call the president's chief of staff and ask if the president will sign an order permitting Richard Welch to be buried at Arlington? No CIA personnel killed in the line of duty had ever been buried at Arlington, but Richard Welch to the agency now was a martyr, and a martyr to this disclosure. So I called his president's chief of staff, whom I had had some dealings with, known over the years, and I explained the case. He said, I'll talk to the president, be back in touch. This is all happening at 8, 9 o'clock on Christmas Eve. Phone rings in a couple of hours, and he said the president will sign the order. And I called Bill Colby and said, Mr. Welch can be buried at Arlington. Now, the irony of all this is the chief of staff's name is Richard Cheney.
Let me try to encapsulate a couple of questions for you, Senator, that all kind of are built around the sense that the way in which this administration employs the term terrorism or the global war on terror is, it, in some profound sense, misleading. Either it's the ideological equivalent of the anti-communist crusade, or it's such a general term that it leaves us with a very unsatisfactory sense of what we're actually about. So could you unpack that a bit and share with us your view?
Well, the shorthand critique of the war on terrorism was offered by a number of people, including a former staff member of mine, Bill Lind, whom I cite at numerous points in the book for his theories on military reform and what he calls fourth-generation warfare. And he and others pointed out that to declare war on terrorism would be the World War II equivalent would be if we had declared war on Blitzkrieg. Terrorism is a method. It isn't a ideology. It is a method that's been used throughout human history. It's a method to, usually by stateless nations or non-state actors, to achieve some objective. In this case, the only objective of al-Qaeda's version of terrorism is to kill Americans. There is no political agenda that anybody can fathom. There is no way, there's no list of demands that if we met, Al-Qaeda would quit attacking us. They hate our culture, what we stand for, our values, and all the rest, and they mean to destroy us. So there should be no doubt, and there was no doubt in Afghanistan, that the nation is united to stop this, and we will use every means possible, including military and paramilitary means, to do so. Now, I think it is too bad, historically, that in the fall of 2002, we had bin Laden and, frankly, much of Al-Qaeda captured or pinned into the back up against the mountains in Tora Bora and pulled our forces out to deploy them in the Middle East to begin the preparation for the attack of Saddam Hussein. That is a factual matter of record. And no one has had to account for that, in my judgment, since the heyday of the fall of 2002 and early 2003, when all of the administration officials were on weekly on the Sunday chat show saying Saddam Hussein is the new terrorist threat. In any case, history will have to deal with that, what role Iraq played in all this. The neoconservative doctrine of peace in the Middle East will be achieved by overthrowing Saddam Hussein. I think we're beginning to see just the reverse results of that theory. The big mistake, in my judgment, was to declare war on terrorism. Terrorism is a criminal activity, and you treat crime and war much, much differently. The 101st Airborne, 82nd Airborne, 1st Marine Division cannot defeat terrorism. We are using the wrong methods. What can defeat terrorism is superior intelligence cooperatively with our allies, finding them, human intelligence, and I talk about creating a new human intelligence core within, as an adjunct, in a way, to the CIA, and recruited heavily from the Arab American community. You're not about to send a graduate of Yale into one of the cells in Europe speaking broken Arabic and be convincing. And a number of other steps of that sort. But this is a paramilitary or police effort. You've got to find them, and you have to destroy them. But if some of you have seen the powerful movie Munich, you have to understand that you can't destroy yourself in the process, and that's a big challenge for a democracy.
I have a related question, another softball for you. And in posing it, I'm invoking Sam Huntington, in a sense, regarding
Mr. Clash himself.
Mr. Clash. And the question is, does Islam pose an inevitable threat to Western civilization, in your judgment?
Does Islam? No, of course not. Of course not. Nor does Christianity pose a threat to the world of Islam. It is ironic, I think, and even though I have a degree in divinity, I'd really like to know the history of Jerusalem better, because it is the capital of three major Western or world religions. And in many ways, if you look at it in the benign sense, those three religions have a lot in common. And depending on your reading of the Quran and even portions of the Bible, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and so on, there's a lot of vengeance in all three of those religions, and harsh dealings with enemies, and on and on and on. It's not just the Quran. It's the Old Testament, not less the New Testament, but certainly the Old Testament. And so you can argue from any direction you want to that the other religions are evil and out to kill you, and you have to protect yourself. I'm not saying that. I think the great irony of the protests about the cartoon is, as Tom Friedman and many others have written, the same outrage is not demonstrated when Arabic cartoonists vilify Israel and the United States. So there is a double standard going on here. The unempowered youth of these various Islamic capitals or Arab capitals out in the streets, killed and being killed, and burning down embassies and so on because of a cartoon, when it's daily in most of that region, vilification and pillaring of the United States, the great Satan, and Israel. So you would hope at least there would be the mullahs, if Friedman is right, to argue that there has to be some moderate leadership from the Arab community, broadly defined, to point these things out. And it is a great tragedy for the Arab world and the Islamic world that those moderate voices are not being heard.
We've received several cards focusing on the question of the media's coverage of security issues. How do you think the media does overall? Are they too superficial, too episodic, et cetera, et cetera?
I always have to smile because there was a period of time in my life where I couldn't say anything about the media. Most of you are too young to remember those days. Because any question like that I answered, the headline was Hart blames the media. But I think hopefully beyond that, hopefully, mostly. There is great mystery, and I don't quite understand why, that the American press media have been so uncritical and lacking in intensity in getting behind a lot of the events of the past 4 or 5 years, not just Iraq, but the NSA and so on. Now, you give Mr. Risen and the New York Times credit for breaking, after a year of knowing about it, breaking the NSA story. But, of course, then you have Donald Rumsfeld on television saying they've just destroyed our national security. And I think for a whole variety of reasons, the concentration of ownership, the insertion of ideology into the American press corps, as if nowhere else in Fox News, and a variety of things like that. I mean, there's a radio station in Denver that is dawn to dusk, dawn to midnight, 24 hours, I suppose, conservative to right-wing opinion. And endlessly it comments on the liberal media. And I just think this is such hypocrisy. I mean, they own the media. What are they talking about? What liberal media is it? Whatever liberal they think liberal, New York Times or CBS or anything else, has gone quiet. The networks have pulled back on their foreign. I mean, part of the reason they can't cover in this age of globalization and the shrinking world international news is they've closed all their foreign bureaus. And it's because, I guess, they make more money with Jerry Springer and Bill O'Reilly and things like that than they do reporting on what's going on in not just Baghdad, but Beijing and Moscow and Buenos Aires and a variety of other places. So I think any fair judgment on the role of the media on Iraq or any of the major topics of our day would be a C-minus at best.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former Senator Gary Hart, author of his newest book, The Shield and the Cloak. I'm going to ask you to put your military reformer hat on now, and there are several questions that have come from the audience about basically how do we get our arms around what, in the opinion of several members of the audience, is a profoundly broken system with respect to military authorization appropriation.
Oh, there's so much to be done across the board. I don't think it's difficult to know where to start. The military reform movement began in the late 70s because there were new members of Congress like myself who sought out assignment on the military committees and very quickly became tired and frustrated by the old debate over spend less, spend more, authorize this carrier, vote against this carrier, new missile systems, and it was all weapons-oriented, and it was all about spending. And that's about all the debate went on in the Senate and House Armed Services Committee, was should we authorize this new plane or should we vote against this new tank and so on. And so it got to be very frustrating. About that time, along came a retired Air Force colonel named John Boyd. John Boyd had a very conceptual idea about what it meant to win in combat. And it wasn't about having the fastest airplane or any of the rest of it. It had to do with how you approached the enemy. It was almost in the tradition of Sun Tzu, that wars are won, in effect, up here and not just here. And that attracted many of us. And I helped form something called the Military Reform Caucus. The third member of that caucus was a first-term congressman from Georgia named Newt Gingrich. So this was across the ideological spectrum and the party lines and the two houses. And we got to up to 80 or 100 members of Congress by 85, 86. And I went off to do other things. And the Congressional Reform Caucus kind of atrophied. But 25 years later, Donald Rumsfeld is beginning to implement some of the force structure changes that we advocated. Lighter, more mobile, smaller, quicker, more lethal, et cetera. And it's necessary for the conflict of the, I said the fourth revolution was the changing nature of conflict. If you want to know what warfare in the 21st century is going to look like, don't read World War II. Don't read Korean War. Don't read the Vietnam War. Read the press reporting on the Clinton intervention in Mogadishu in Somalia, Black Hawk Down, and read the reporting from Fallujah. And that's the warfare of the future. Low-intensity urban conflict among tribes, clans, and gangs. Not uniformed military, not armies in the field, not great weapon systems, improvised weapons used by non-uniformed people against civilian targets, violating all of the rules of warfare. We're not prepared for it. And it's not just the equipment. I mean, first of all, as I said before, it's going to take 15 or 20 years to rebuild the Army and the Marine Corps after Iraq, even if we left today. Not only the personnel, but also the equipment. Same thing happened in Vietnam. You don't go to war and leave the war, winning or losing, in the same condition that you entered the war. And it's going to take a long time to rebuild this force. In the meantime, we pray to God the North Koreans don't decide to attack Seoul, because we're not prepared to do much there. The Air Force and the Navy can do it, but the Army and the Marine Corps can't. We better hope that the Iranians don't buy some bombs from the Russians, which I don't think they're going to do, but develop them very quickly, because we couldn't invade Iran today if we wanted to, or had to. We'd be in big, big trouble. So there are a lot of changes that have to be made, but particularly in the mindset of what conflict in the 21st century is going to look like, what kind of forces we need to approach that and defeat it or condition it. And at the end of the day, when you go through that process, you end up with an almost totally different Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force than you have today. In fact, all those services are going to look much more like the Marines, and the Marines are going to look much more like the Delta Force. And if you saw pictures of the Delta Force in Afghanistan, these were guys with shaggy hair, beards, wearing native costumes, riding on donkeys. So all the B-2 bombers in the world weren't able to kill Saddam Hussein. We had guys out there with daggers in their teeth eating snails and drinking the blood of snakes out to kill them hand to hand. And it sounds primitive, but I think that's where we're headed.
In the time that remains to us tonight, I'm going to ask Senator Hart to put on yet a third hat. He's talked about U.S. foreign and security policies, talked about military reform. A significant plurality in the audience here in San Francisco is very curious about your views on politics in this country. And I'm going to start with a relatively straightforward one, but an important one, and that is, can the Democrats gain back the trust of voters with respect to national security issues, and if so, how?
Well, that's the primary question. I was quoted relatively accurately in a recent one-page profile in the New York Times magazine saying I wasn't very good at politics, and I think I proved that over and over again.
Sorry.
So I may be disqualified from commenting on politics at all. But part of what this book is about, this book is written for Democrats is more than anyone else, although I'm hopeful a few of my Republican friends may read it. It is an effort to structure a positive, thoughtful, cohesive national security policy or international security policy for the United States as an alternative to the Bush national security strategy announced in October of 2002, and most of which was written by a very close personal friend of both Professor Blacker and myself, who shall go nameless even though she's Secretary of State. We're not going to protect ourselves or be secure by preemptive warfare or even, as the doctrine calls for, military superiority. We're going to be secure, if not following the heart approach, a more thoughtful and more broad-based and more collegial and cooperative and internationalist foreign policy and defense policy. The Democratic Party will not obtain governing power in this country or deserve to until it recaptures the confidence of the American people in our ability to protect them. And every poll since Vietnam, and this all began in Vietnam when the party badly divided, and I was somewhere near the center of all that at the time, until those polls quit showing that on the issue of who do you think is best prepared and equipped to defend America, 60-40 or 70-30 Republicans. So we've got to overcome that perception, and we are not going to do it either by voting for, as many Democrats did, the war resolution without question, or simply being against all things military. And I talk about the fact in here that every time many Democrats get anywhere near the Defense Department, they break out into a sweat. So we've got to get over that notion. Yeah, ironically, in 1976, a former colleague of mine, Bob Dole, in the vice presidential debate of that national election said, if you want to go to war, vote Democratic. I almost had to laugh because the Democratic Party was going exactly the opposite way, even as he spoke. But what he was saying was traditional 19th and 20th century Republican isolationist Kansas rhetoric about Democrats. And I heard it growing up in Kansas. If you elect Democrats, they'll get us into a war. I heard it over and over and over again. Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson. So Republican doctrine, up until they decided to invade the world, was let's stay home. We don't need to lose American lives in foreign adventures. And it had deep roots in the founding of our country. But they've done it's not just the Democratic Party that's changed. The Republican Party has changed. They've become the interventionist party. We were the interventionist party throughout much of the 20th century, and suddenly, under Ronald Reagan and beyond, the Republicans became the intervention party and overthrew 100 or 150 years of Republican doctrine and theory. So I don't think any Democrat will win in 08 without approaching the issue of security much more broadly and much more thoughtfully and much more convincingly than most of our candidates have done for the past 25 or 30 years.
We have only a minute or two left, and I'm going to take advantage of the lateness of the hour to ask you, I think, a very loaded question.
All questions are loaded.
Sorry, sir, yeah. What's the strongest team that the Democrats could field in 2008?
Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Senator Gary Hart, author of The Shield and the Cloak, Security for the Commons, for his comments today. I also want to thank our audiences here in San Francisco and on the radio. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is hereby adjourned.